Great witches, you guys. Thank you so much. There's something, don't you love the, I call it interrogatory sarcasm that the English do, and you saw a little bit of it in that scene, where you can pretty much say anything as long as it's in the form of a question, and they do it all the time. When I was learning the British idiom to write this book, you could say, well, Nigel's grandma, she'd shag a hedgehog for a tube ticket, wouldn't she? Yes. Tony Blair turned out to be a bit of a wanker, didn't he? So that was a nice example of that. I don't have anything else to say. Oh my God, I've got to make you guys read again. No, I'm kidding. No, I don't have anything else to say. I've got to. Sort of the seminal, I said this before twice, but there are scenes that had to be, that everybody knows. If you go to see Hamlet, you're going to see, the soliloquy is the biggie. In King Lear, it's the storm scene. And it's one of the reasons I think they say that Lear is one of the hardest parts to play for an actor, because you have to reach a certain maturity to do it with any credibility, but it requires an extraordinary amount of energy to do King Lear, simply because of the pace of the whining that goes on through the entire play. But this scene is I think it's the one that probably kills more Lears than any of the others, the storm scene, and it sort of cements the fool's relationship with Lear in the actual play of King Lear. When Ian McKellen did this, he played Lear in London in Stratford-on-Avon, and I guess now you can see that performance on BBC. A couple of years ago, I guess he did this whole storm scene naked, Howard's going to play King Lear tonight, and he tells me that he's going to spare us that. I was just grateful that Ian McKellen didn't bring that into his Magneto role, Wolverine just snatches junk right off. Very short movie. I think the other thing is that this, along with some of the battle scenes, the battle scene from Henry V comes to mind, are things that are very hard to stage. So we're going to let you imagine most of the storm. And this is from William Shakespeare's King Lear, The Storm.
Blow, winds, and crack your cheeks! Rain! Blow! You cataracts and hurricanes, spout till you have drenched our steeple, drowned our cots! You sulphurous and hot-exploding fires, vaunt currents of oak-cleaving thunderbolts, singe my white head! And thou, old shaking thunder, smite flat the thick rotundity of the world.
An uncle, court holy water in a dry house is better than this rainwater out of doors. Good uncle, in and ask thy daughter's blessing. Here's a knight pities neither wise man nor fool.
Rumble thy belly full, spit fire, spout rain. The rain, wind, thunder, fire are my daughters. I tax not you, you elements, with unkindness. I never gave you kingdom, called you children. You owe me no subscription. Then let fall your horrible pleasure. Here I stand, your slave, a poor, infirm, weak, and despised old man.
He that has and a little tiny wit with hey-ho, the wind and the rain must make content with his fortunes fit, for the rain it raineth every day.
True, my good boy. Come, bring us to this hovel.
And now my version, the version from Fool of the Storm.
Blow, wind, crash your cheeks! Rage, blow!
The old man had perched himself on the top of a hill outside of Gloucester and was shouting into the wind like a bloody lunatic. even as lightning raked the sky with white hot claws and thunder shook me to my ribs. Come in from there, you bloody decrepit old loony! I huddled under a holly bush nearby, drenched and cold at the end of my patience with the old man. Come back to Gloucester and ask shelter from your daughters.
Oh, ye heartless gods! Send your oak-cleaving thunderbolts down on me! Burn me with your sulphurous and life-ending fires! Send my white head and reduce me to a pillar of ash! Strike me dead! Let your wrath take fiery form and smite me!
The old man paused as a thunderbolt split a tree in the heath with a blinding fire and a noise that would send statues to shitting themselves. I ran out from under my bush to the king's side. Come in, uncle! Take some shelter under a shrub, if only to take the sting out of the rain.
I need no shelter. Let nature take her naked revenge.
Oh, fine then. You won't be needing this. I took the old man's heavy fur cape, tossed him my sodden woolen cloak, and retreated to my shrubbery in the relative shelter of the heavy animal skin.
Hey!
Go on! Crack the sky! Fry your old head! Mash your balls! Etc., etc. I'll prompt you if you lose your place.
Mighty Thor! Send your thunderbolts to cease this weary heart! Neptune's waves! Beat these limbs from their joints. Hack its claws, tear my liver, and snap at my soul. Ball, blast my bowels from their unhealthy home.
The old man stopped his tirade for a moment, and the madness went out of his eyes. He looked to me.
It's really fucking cold.
I'm being struck by a bolt of bloody obvious on the road to Damascus, isn't it? I held open the great fur cloak and nodded for the old man to come and join me under my shrubbery. He crept down the hill and ducked under the cover with me. The old man shuddered and put his skeletal arm around my shoulders.
Rather closer than we're accustomed to.
I caught some freezing rain and cupped it in my hand and held it for him to sip.
No. Don't make me laugh, boy. I'm mad with grief and rage. No stomach for your jests. You should stand clear, lest the thunderbolt scorch you when the gods heed my challenge.
Nuncle, begging your pardon, but you arrogant old tosser. The gods aren't going to strike you down with a thunderbolt simply because you asked them. Why would they accommodate you with a thunderbolt? More likely a carbuncle festered and gone fatal. Or perhaps a thankless child or two, being how the gods love their irony.
Cheek!
Yes, cheeky gods they are. You named off a bushel of them, too. Now if you are struck down, we won't even know who to blame. Unless lightning brands a signature in your old hide.
I said 1,000 monks and nuns pray for my forgiveness. The pagans slaughter goats by the herd for my salvation. But I fear it is not enough. Not once did I act in the interest of my people. Not once did I act in the interest of my wives, of my daughters' mothers. I have served myself as God, and I find I am little forgiven. Do you know how I became king?
Pulled a sword out of a stone and slayed a dragon.
That never happened.
Buggered if I know then, Nuncle. How did Leo become king?
My own father. I murdered him. I do not deserve a noble death.
I was speechless. I had been in service of the king over a decade and never had I heard of this. But before I could gather my wits for a reply, lightning cracked the sky, illuminating a hulking creature that was making its way across the hillside toward us. What's that?
A demon. The gods have sent a monster to take their revenge on me.
The thing was covered in slime and walking as if it had just been constructed from the very earth over which it slogged.
Although it described the shape of a man, I could see long, slimy tendrils dragging from it and mud oozing off it. I felt for the daggers at the small of my back and pulled one from its sheath. Come hither, demon! Pocket's got a coach ride back to the underworld for thee.
No, let it take me!
Suddenly the old man shrugged off his fur cape and charged at the monster, his arms wide, as if offering his very heart to the beast.
Slay me, merciless god! Rend this black heart from Britain's chest!
But I could not stop him, and the old man fell into the beast's arms. But, to my surprise, there was no tearing of limbs or bashing of brains. The thing caught the old man and lowered him gently to the ground. I lowered my blade and inched forward. Leave him, beast! The thing was kneeling over Lear, whose eyes were rolled back in his head, even as he twitched as if in a fit. The beast looked at me, and I saw streaks of pink through the mud, the whites of his eyes.
Help me! Help me get him to shelter!
I stepped forth and wiped the mud away from the thing's face. It was a man, covered with mud so thick it even ran out of his mouth and coated his teeth. But a man, just the same. Vines or rags trailed off its arms. I couldn't tell which.
Help, poor Tom! Bring him out of the cold!
I sheathed my dagger, retrieved the old man's cape, and helped the muddy, naked bloke carry King Lear into the wood.
That scene obviously takes a lot of energy, and thank you guys for that. This is the point in the play and in the book where everything just sort of becomes this stormy, muddy mess, and not giving much away, the crazy monster man is Edmund, who is the son of Gloucester. Now, in the play, there's sort of a backstory, a second plot line that's going through. I don't have any notes. They have a script. I'm just making this up as I go along. I keep looking at this, but all it says is scene 8. Thank you. One of the 8 guys. What's going on, and it actually is in the book, but it's a second plot with the family Gloucester, is that the Earl of Gloucester has been blind by the Duke of Cornwall, Regan's husband, and it's a horrific scene, They think he's a traitor because he's helped his old friend King Lear, and he's tortured, and Cornwall leaps on him and tears his eyes out of his head. The interesting thing to me is of all the shagging and torture and crazy stuff that goes on in Fool, the few letters I've gotten of people that were really offended, they were offended by, why would I have that violent scene of that poor old man having his eyes poked out? And I'm like, I think you see now why I had to fix Shakespeare's play. But it really is interesting, since that's the one thing I didn't come up with. Shortly after this happens, Gloucester is wandering in the moors, Drool sort of saves him from falling in the moat, and they all end up there's a lot of hovels in my version of King Lear. So if we ever do stage the entire thing, we just basically need, like one castle and a hovel, and we're good. The final scene that our players are going to do for you tonight takes place in the hovel. I should say that there's a point, one of my favorite scenes in Shakespeare's play is where Edgar is still in disguise as just the nutter, and he's helping Gloucester in Dover. And Gloucester decides he's going to take his own life. He's going to jump off the cliff. And so Edgar takes him like to the top of a rock that's about a foot tall and says, can't you see down below the horses, and they're the size of ants, and the people are the size of mice, and he convinces Gloucester that he's jumped off the cliffs of Dover and he hasn't died. He's somehow been miraculously resurrected. This is sort of my version of the faked suicide of Gloucester just finding himself, not unlike his friend Lear, just so wretched he can't go on. And We call this Tom's Hubble, I throw myself on a puppet.
When we arrived at the hovel, Tom of Bedlam stood outside, naked in the rain,
barking. The barking bloke is naked,
said Drew, for once not singing praise to St. Obvious, as we were actually traveling with a blind fellow. I drew, but the question is he naked because he's barking, or is he barking because he's naked?
I'm hungry.
Poor Tom is cold and cursed,
said Tom between barking fits, and for the first time seeing him in daylight and mostly clean, I was taken aback. Without the coat of mud, Tom looked familiar, very familiar. Tom of Bedlam was, in fact, Edgar of Gloucester, the Earl's legitimate son. Tom, why are you out here?
Poor Tom. That old knight Kai said he had to stand in the rain until he was clean and didn't stink anymore.
And did he tell you to bark and talk about yourself in the third person?
No, I thought up that bit on my own.
Come inside, Tom. Help Drew with this old fellow. Tom looked at Gloucester for the first time, and his eyes went wide, and he sank to his knees.
By the cruelty of the gods, he's blind.
Be steadfast, Edgar. Your father needs your help. In that moment, a light came into his eye like the spark of sanity returning, and he nodded and stood up, taking the Earl's arm. Shall a madman rise to lead the blind?
Come, good sir. Tom is mad, but he is not beyond aiding a stranger in distress.
Just let me die. Give me a rope that I may stretch my neck until my breath is gone.
He does that a lot. I opened the door, expecting to see Lear and Kent outside, but the hovel was empty, and the fire had died down to embers. Tom, where is the king?
He and his knight set out for Dover.
Without me?
The king was mad to be back in the storm. 'Twas the old knight said to tell you they were headed for Dover.
Here, bring the Earl inside. Drew, throw some wood on the fire. We can stay long enough to eat and dry out, but we must be after the king. Drew ducked through the door and spotted Jones sitting on a bench by the fire where I had left him.
Jones! My friend!
Drew is somewhat unclear on the art of ventriloquism. And although I have explained to him that Jones speaks only through me, he has developed an attachment to the part. Hello, Drew! You great soft dust-brained buffoon! Put me down and stoke the fire! Drew tucked the puppet stick in his belt and began breaking up kindling with a hatchet by the hearth. Edgar did his best to bandage Gloucester's eyes, and the old man settled down enough to eat some cheese and drink a little wine. Unfortunately, the wine and the blood loss, no doubt, took the Earl from inconsolable wailing grief to a soul-smothering, sable-colored melancholy.
My wife died thinking me a whoremonger. My father thought me damned for not following his faith, and my sons are both villains. Now I thought for a turn that Edmund might have redeemed his bastardy by being good and true, by fighting infidels in the crusade. But he is more of a traitor than his legitimate brother.
Edgar is no traitor. Even as I said it, Edgar held his finger to his lips and signaled for me not to speak further. I nodded to show I would not give away his identity. He could be Tom as long as he wished, or for as long as he needed, for all I cared, as long as he put on some bloody trousers. Edgar was always true to you, my lord. His treachery was all devised for your eyes by the bastard Edmund. It was two sons' worth of evil done by one. Edgar may not be the sharpest arrow in the quiver, but he is no traitor. Edgar raised an eyebrow to me in question. You make no case for your intelligence sitting there naked and shivering when there's a fire and blankets you can fashion into warm robes, good Tom. He rose from his father's side and went over to the fire.
Then it is I who have betrayed Edgar. Oh, the gods have seen fit to rain misery down on me for my unsteady heart.
I have sent a good son into exile with hounds at his heels and left only the worms as my heir to my only estate, this wither, blind body. Oh, we are but soft and squishy. Bags of mortality rolling in a bin of sharp circumstance, leaking life as we collapse, flattered into our own despair.
It's all right, my lord. You ain't leaking hardly at all.
Let me send this broken house to ruin and rot in death's eternal cold. Let me shuffle off this mortal coil. Let my sons betray, my king usurp, my estate seize. Let me end this torture.
He really was making a very good argument. And the old man grabbed Jones and tore him out of Drool's belt.
Give me your sword, good knight.
Edgar made to stop his father, and I threw out an arm to hold him back. A toss of my head stopped Drool from interceding. The old man stood, put the stick end of Drool under his ribcage, and then fell forward onto the dirt floor. The breath shot from his body, and the old man wheezed in pain. My cup of wine had been warming by the fire, and I threw it onto the old man's chest.
I hope slain the lifeblood runs from me even now.
Edgar again tried to go to his father, and I held him back. Drool was covering his mouth, trying not to laugh.
I grow cold. Cold! But at least I take my wrongdoings to my grave.
You know, my lord, the evil that men do lives after them. The good is oft interred with their bones. Or so I've heard.
Edgar, my boy, wherever you are, forgive me. Forgive me!
The old man rolled on the floor and seemed somewhat surprised when the sword on which he thought he had himself impaled fell away.
There, forgive me that I did not serve you better!
Look at that. You can see his black soul rising from his body. Oh, great carrion birds are rending poor Gloucester's soul to tatters. Oh, fate's revenge is upon him. He suffers.
I suffer.
Yes, he is bound to the darkest depths of Hades, never to rise again.
Down to the abyss I go, forever a stranger to light and warmth.
Oh, cold and lonely death has taken him, and a right shit he was in life. Likely he'll be buggered by a billion barb-dicked devils now.
A cold and lonely death has been.
No, it hasn't.
What?
You're not dead.
Well, soon then. I mean, I've fallen on this cruel blade and my life runs wet and sticky between my fingers.
You've fallen on a puppet.
No, I haven't. It's a sword. I took it from that soldier.
You took my puppet stick from my apprentice. You've thrown yourself on a puppet.
You knave! Pocket, you're not trustworthy and would jest at a man even as his life drains. Where is that naked madman who was helping me?
You threw yourself on a puppet.
So I'm not dead.
Correct.
I threw myself on a puppy.
That's what I've been saying.
Wicked little man, Pocket!
So, my lord, how do you feel now that you've returned from the dead?
Better.
Good. Then let me present Edgar of Gloucester, the erstwhile naked nutter who shall see you to Dover and your king.
Hello, Father.
rudeness and filial snogging and overall business was somewhat nauseating. A moment passed of quiet sobbing from the two men before the Earl resumed his wailing.
Oh, Edgar! I have wronged thee, and no forgiveness from you can undo my wretchedness.
Oh, for fuck's sake. Come, Drool, let us go find Lear and on to Dover in the sanctuary of the bloody fucking French.
But the storm still rages.
I've been wandering in this storm for days now. I'm as wet and as cold as I know how to get. And no doubt a fever will descend any hour now and crush my delicate form with heavy heat. But by the rug-munching balls of Sappho, I will not spend another hour listening to a blind old nutter wail on about his wrongdoings when there's a stack of wrongs yet to be done. Carpe diem, Edgar, carpe diem.
Fish of the day.
Of the bloody day. I liked you better when you were eating frogs and seeing demons in the lawn. Drool, leave them half the food and wrap yourself as warm as you can. We're off to find the king. We'll see you in Dover.
See you in Dover.
Terrific, you guys. I'm going to inflict myself on you guys for a little while longer. We're going to do some Q&A and everything, but before we go any further, I have to acknowledge the amazing work and talent of our actors, Richard Borg. Kozlowski, Jay Leibowitz, Jessica Morris, and Aaron Hartley, the Shakespeare Company of New Jersey, take it out. Lights up? No? Evidently, I'm not the director. Really? Can we bring the house lights up? There you go. Hello? Oh, wow. We're full. I thought there was like eight of you, but you were really loud. Hi. It's nice to see you. Yeah, thank you. You can tell my voice is going to bring we only have about not that long. I'll sign books after all this. Joe will come up. Joe is our director. Joe, are you there?
Yes.
Okay. He's in kabuki. He's all black in the black corner. Joe Disher rehearsed and directed this. Since I can see you guys now, how many of you got to come and visit with me when I was on tour for Fool? Not that many of you. Okay. Well, I'll do a quick version of what I learned in England when I was researching Fool, and then we'll do some questions if that's okay. And then Joe's going to help me with that. If I can't continue to talk, he'll just make up answers for you. First, this is a huge experiment, and Obviously, I've never rehearsed this before. I'm humbled by these people who can do this so well and have only a couple of read-throughs. But I thank you so much for traveling and coming and paying money to... This was kind of like, who knows what's going to happen? It could be a rave and there's no drugs. or music. Just a warehouse. to make your own fun. But clearly, these guys were worth it, and I won't hopefully detract from it that much. This project started, I guess, about 3.5 years ago, and I decided, well, I'm going to go to England and look at old stuff, because that's where they keep it. And it turned out, because it, as I said before about the historical stuff just not really being accurate, I just got to pick and choose. But I did learn stuff while I was in England, and I'll share that with you because unless it's not in this set of notes, in which case I won't be sharing it. I have only recently, in the last few years, been able to travel abroad. I know many of you have traveled quite a bit, but I was poor. So, and now I'm not anymore. Thank you. one of the things that I learned in England is that people apologize a lot. Everywhere you go, they say, sorry. And you know, whether they run, they just make eye contact. They go, oh, sorry. And at first, you think, well, okay, that's all right. It's fine. And you can basically spend an entire day walking around London being apologized to by English people. And so it's all right. And you're a little taken aback, but by the end of the day, you're thinking you ought to be. So just be prepared for that, I guess. The driving on the left thing. I always knew that the English drove on the left, but I didn't know why. You guys know why? I'll tell you why. Even if you don't. It's because that in the days of swords and knights and so forth. Most of the swordsmen were right-handed, and so their swords stuck out on their left side. So if you pass left to left, your sword's hit, and then you had to stop and fight, and you never got anything done. So if you drive on the other side of the road, then your sword sticks out in the ditch, and then it's fine. And the other place they drive on that side of the road is Japan, same reason, samurais. Now, I don't know why they do it now, because you hardly see anybody going down the road in a Jaguar with a sword out the window, but... And my other theory is it's easier to run over Americans because you're looking the wrong way to cross the street. you're like, and then they're sorry. So just so you know, be careful crossing the street. In elevators, or in England, elevators talk. I thought Douglas Adams made that up, but they really do. You're on the second floor. Sorry. I guess for either people just need politeness on every floor or something like that, or the visually impaired. They say in the tube, in the subway, that's mind the gap. And if you don't mind the gap, then you get caught in the door then as your head beats against the track. Sorry. Let's see. Although everybody's polite in England pretty much unless they're drunk, which there's a lot of drunk people in England. They actually had to pad the light posts in London in certain neighborhoods because people would walk into them drunk texting. When, I'm not kidding. When I was over there, it was on the news. Yes, they're padding all of the, you know, so you can, it's like, yeah, no sense just saying, I think you've had enough. You know, they pad I guess you live in Nerf World after a while. Now I'm bloody pissed, but nothing can hurt me. So let's see. The dog's bollocks is a good thing. Because he licks them all. Who knew? But a dog's breakfast is a bad thing. Sweaters are called jumpers. People who jump up and down constantly are sweaters. Pants are called trousers. Panties are called pants. that can get you in an embarrassing. If someone